Lesson 12. Concentration. You can do it if you believe you can. This lesson occupies a keystone position in this course because the psychological law upon which it is based is of vital importance to every other lesson of the course. Let me first define the word concentration as it is used in this lesson. Concentration is the act of focusing the mind on a given desire until ways and means for its realization have been worked out and successfully put into operation. Two important laws enter into the act of concentrating the mind on a given desire. One is the law of autosuggestion, and the other is the law of habit. The former having been fully described in the previous lesson, I will now briefly describe the law of habit. Habit grows out of environment. The sum total of sources by which you are influenced by and through the aid of the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and feeling. And out of doing the same thing in the same way over and over again, out of repetition, out of thinking the same thoughts over and over. Once formed, a habit is hard to break. Except on rare occasions when the mind rises above environment, the human mind draws from the surrounding environment the material out of which thought is created. Habit crystallizes this thought into a permanent fixture, storing it away in the subconscious mind, where it becomes a vital part of our personality that silently influences our actions, forms our prejudices and our biases, and controls our opinions. A great philosopher had in mind the power of habit when he said, "We first endure, then pity, and finally embrace," in speaking of the manner in which honest men come to indulge in crime. We begin to see, therefore, the importance of selecting our environment with the greatest of care, because environment is the mental feeding ground out of which the food that goes into our minds is extracted. The forces of habit. It has been said that all people are creatures of habit, and that habit is a cable. We weave a thread of it each day and become so strong that we cannot break it. If it is true that habit can compel us against our will, desire, and inclination, and thereby dominate our actions and character, then it can also be mastered, harnessed, and directed for our good. Thousands of people have applied this knowledge and have turned the force of habit into new channels. A habit is a mental path over which our actions have traveled for some time, each passing making the path a little deeper and a little wider. If you have to walk over a field or through a forest, you know how natural it is to choose the clearest path. The line of mental action is precisely the same. It is movement along the lines of least resistance, passage over the well. Habits are created by repetition and are formed in accordance to a natural law, observable in all animate things, and some would say, in inanimate things as well. For instance, a piece of paper once folded in a certain way will fold along the same lines the next time. Clothing forms into creases according to the person wearing it, and these creases once formed will remain. All users of any kind of machinery know that as a machine is first broken in, so it will tend to run thereafter. Rivers and streams cut their courses through the land along the lines of least resistance. The law is in operation everywhere. These examples will give you an idea of the nature of habit and will aid you in forming new mental paths, new mental creases. The best, and one might say the only, way that old habits may be broken is to form new habits to counteract and replace the undesirable ones. Form new mental paths over which to travel, and soon the old ones will become less distinct. Every time you travel over the path of the desirable mental habit, you make that new path deeper and wider, and so much easier to travel thereafter. This mental path-making is very important, and I cannot urge you too strongly to start making the desirable mental paths over which you wish to travel. The following are the rules through which you may form the habits you desire. Number 1. At the beginning of the formation of a new habit, put force and enthusiasm into your expression. Feel what you think. Remember that you are taking the first steps toward making your new mental paths, and that it is much harder at first than it will be afterwards. At the beginning, make each path as clear and deep as you can, so that you can readily see it the next time you wish to follow it. Number 2. Keep your attention firmly concentrated on your new path building and forget all about the old paths. Concern yourself only with the new ones that you are building to order. Number 3. Travel over your newly made paths as often as possible. Create opportunities for doing so without waiting for them to arise through luck or chance. The more often you go over the new paths, the sooner they will become well-worn and easily traveled. Number 4. Resist the temptation to travel over the older, easier paths that you have been using in the past. Every time you resist a temptation, the stronger you become, and the easier it will be for you to do so the next time. But every time you yield to the temptation, the easier it becomes to yield again, and the more difficult it becomes to resist the next time. This is the critical time. Prove your determination, persistency, and willpower now, at the very beginning. Number 5. Be sure that you have mapped out the right path as your definite chief aim, and then go ahead without fear and without allowing yourself to doubt. Select your goal, then make good, deep, wide mental paths leading straight to it. As you have already observed, there is a close relationship between habit and auto-suggestion. Through habit, an act repeatedly performed in the same manner has a tendency to become permanent, and eventually we come to perform the act automatically or unconsciously. In playing a piano, for example, the artist can play a familiar piece while his or her conscious mind is on some other subject. Auto-suggestion is the tool with which we dig a mental path. Concentration is the hand that holds the tool, and habit is the map or blueprint that the mental path follows. An idea or desire to be transformed into terms of action or physical reality must be held in the conscious mind faithfully and persistently until habit begins to give it permanent form. As we have already seen, we absorb the material for thought from our surrounding environment. The term environment covers a very broad field. It consists of the books we read, the people with whom we associate, the community in which we live, the nature of the work we do, the country or nation in which we reside, the clothes we wear, the songs we sing, and most important of all, the religious and intellectual training we receive prior to the age of 14 years. The purpose of analyzing the subject of environment is to show its direct relationship to the personality we are developing, and how its influence will give us the materials out of which we may attain our definite chief aim in life. The mind feeds upon that which we supply it, or that which is forced upon it through our environment. Therefore, let us select our environment as much as possible with the object of supplying the mind with suitable material out of which to carry on its work. If your environment is not to your liking, change it. The first step is to create in your own mind a clear, well-defined picture of the environment in which you believe you could best attain your definite chief aim. Then concentrate your mind on this picture until you transform it into reality. Just as you learned in Lesson 2, Volume 1, the first step you must take in the accomplishment of any desire is to have in your mind an exact picture of what it is that you intend to accomplish. This is also the first principle to be observed in your plans for the achievement of success, and if you fail to observe it, you cannot succeed, except by chance. Your daily associates constitute one of the most important and influential parts of your environment, and may work for your progress or against it. As much as possible, you should select as your closest daily associates those who are in sympathy with your aims and ideals, especially those represented by your definite chief aim. You should make it a point to associate with people whose mental attitudes inspire you with enthusiasm, self-confidence, determination, and ambition. Remember that every word spoken within your hearing, every sight that reaches your eyes, and every sense impression that you receive through any of the five senses influences your thoughts. This being true, can you not see the importance of controlling, as far as possible, the environment in which you live and work? Can you not see the importance of reading books which deal with subjects that are directly related to your definite chief aim? Can you not see the importance of talking with people who are in sympathy with your aims and who will encourage you and spur you on toward their attainment? An observant person could accurately analyze someone by seeing their work environment. A well-organized desk indicates a well-organized mind. Show me the shelves in the store, and I will tell you whether the manager has an organized or a disorganized mind. There is a close relationship between one's mental attitude and one's physical environment. The effects of environment so vitally influence those who work in factories, stores, and offices that employers have become well aware of the importance of creating an environment that inspires and encourages their workers. The Power of Concentration. This brings us to an appropriate place at which to describe the method through which you may apply the principles directly and indirectly related to the subject of concentration. I call this method the magic key to success. In presenting you with this magic key, let me first explain that it is no invention or discovery of mine. It is the same key that is used in one form or another by all groups that are founded on the philosophy of optimism. The magic key offers an irresistible power that all may use. It will unlock the door to riches. It will unlock the door to fame. And, in many instances, it will unlock the door to physical health. It will unlock the door to education and let you into the storehouse of all your latent ability. It will act as a passkey to any position in life for which you are suited. Through the aid of this magic key, we have unlocked the secret doors to all of the world's great inventions. Through its magic powers, all of our great geniuses of the past have been developed. Suppose you are working in a menial position and desire a better place in life. The magic key will help you attain it. This key will unlock prison doors and turn human derelicts into useful, trustworthy human beings. It will turn failure into success and misery into happiness. This magic key is concentration. Now, let me once again define concentration as I use the term. It means the ability, through fixed habit and practice, to keep your mind on one subject until you have thoroughly familiarized yourself with that subject and mastered it. It means the ability to control your attention and focus it on a given problem until you have solved it. It means the ability to throw off the effects of habits that you wish to discard and the power to build new habits. It means complete self-mastery. Concentration is the ability to think as you wish to think, the ability to control your thoughts and direct them to a definite end, and the ability to organize your knowledge into a plan of action that is sound and workable. You can readily see that in concentrating your mind on your definite chief aim in life, you must cover many closely related subjects that blend into each other and complete the main subject on which you are concentrating. From the editors. In the year 2000, Albert Einstein was chosen by Time magazine as Person of the Century. He was described by managing editor Walter Isaacson as both the greatest mind and paramount icon of our age, whose extraordinary brilliance made his face a symbol and his name a synonym for genius. But had Einstein been born today, he might have been diagnosed in his early years as having attention deficit disorder. As a child, he was slow to learn to talk. And as a student, he showed so little promise, he was expelled from school. Isaacson refers to him as the patron saint of distracted school kids. But what Einstein could do was the very thing that Napoleon Hill refers to in this chapter. Once Einstein set himself a definite chief aim, he had a phenomenal ability to focus his concentration. His famous theories were all the result of thought experiments. Experiments that took place inside his mind. Einstein's breakthroughs came, just as Hill suggests, by mentally organizing his knowledge and concentrating on many closely related subjects that blend into each other and complete the main subject. Continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. Ambition and desire are the major factors that enter into the act of successful concentration. Without these factors, the magic key is useless. And the main reason why so few people make use of this key is that most people lack ambition and desire nothing in particular. Desire whatever you may, and if your desire is within reason, and if it is strong enough, the magic key of concentration will help you attain it. There are many scientists and research psychologists who believe that the power of prayer operates through the principle of concentration on the attainment of a deeply seated desire. Nothing was ever created by a human being that was not first created in the imagination, through desire, and then transformed into reality through concentration. Now, let us put the magic key to a test through the aid of a definite formula. First, you must get rid of skepticism and doubt. No unbeliever ever enjoyed the benefits of this magic key. You must believe in the test that you are about to make. We will assume that you have thought something about becoming a successful writer, or perhaps a powerful public speaker, or a successful business executive, or an able financier. We will take public speaking as the subject of this test, but you can change that to your own objective. Just remember that you must follow instructions to the letter. Take a plain sheet of letter-sized paper and on it write the following. I am going to become a powerful public speaker because this will enable me to render the world useful service that is needed, and because it will yield me a financial return that will provide me with the necessary material things of life. I will concentrate my mind on this desire for 10 minutes daily, just before retiring at night and just after arising in the morning, for the purpose of determining just how I shall proceed to transform it into reality. I know that I can become a powerful and magnetic speaker. Therefore, I will permit nothing to interfere with my doing so. Sign this pledge. Then proceed to do as you have given your word that you would do. Keep it up until the desired results have been reached. When you come to do your concentrating, look ahead 1, 3, 5, or even 10 years, and see yourself as the most powerful speaker of your time. See, in your imagination, an appropriate income. See yourself in your home that you have purchased with the proceeds from your efforts as a speaker or a lecturer. See yourself in possession of a nice bank account for your retirement. See yourself as a person of influence due to your great ability as a public speaker. See yourself engaged in a life calling in which you will not fear the loss of your position. Paint this picture clearly through the powers of your imagination, and it will soon become transformed into a beautiful picture of deeply seated desire. Use this desire as the chief object of your concentration and observe what happens. You now understand how the secret of the magic key is concentration. Do not underestimate its power because it did not come to you clothed in mysticism or because it is described in language that anyone can understand. All great truths are simple in final analysis and easily understood. If they are not, they are not great truths. Use the magic key with intelligence and only for the attainment of worthy ends, and it will bring you enduring happiness and success. Forget the mistakes you have made and the failures you have experienced. Quit living in the past, for your yesterdays never return. If your previous efforts have not turned out well, start all over again and make the future tell a story of success. Make a name for yourself and render the world a great service through ambition, desire, and concentrated effort. You can do it if you believe you can. The editor's comment. It is impossible to listen to this or any of the other 3 volumes of The Law of Success without recognizing that the principles Napoleon Hill wrote about are so interrelated and they intersect with each other in so many ways and on so many levels that a key concept or idea may be stated and restated numerous times with slightly different shadings. Hill comments on this himself, pointing out that the repetition is intentional in his structure of lessons that are designed to build one upon the other. Consequently, the editors of this edition have found that in suggesting supplemental materials, certain books and audiobooks also recur frequently. Such is the case with this subject of concentration and Hill's advice to see yourself as you will be when you have already achieved your objective. What Napoleon Hill is advising is not simply daydreaming. It is a very specific technique called visualization, and many people have difficulty achieving the kind of vivid imagery that is required for it to have any real effect. The following books are suggested here because they are particularly helpful in developing the technique of creating powerful mental imagery. Most are also available on audio. Visualization, Directing the Movies of Your Mind, by Adelaide Bry. Creative Visualization, by Shakti Gawain. Psycho-Cybernetics, by Dr. Maxwell Maltz. Getting Well, by Dr. O. Carl Simonton. And The Initiation, by Donald Schnell, which includes a description of the visualization technique in spiritual story form. Also suggested are all of the audiobooks featuring the Silva Method trainer, Hans de Jong, whose tapes include an unusual method of quieting the mind using an audio tone that is designed to put the mind in the alpha state. Resuming Napoleon Hill's original text. When you become familiar with the powers of concentration, it becomes clear why it is so important to choose a definite chief aim as the first step in the attainment of enduring success. The presence of any idea or thought in your consciousness tends to produce an associated feeling and urge you to an appropriate or corresponding action. Hold a deeply seated desire in your consciousness through the principle of concentration, and if you do this with full faith in its realization, that act will attract powers that the entire scientific world has failed to understand or explain. Concentrate your mind on the attainment of the object of a deeply seated desire, and very soon you will attract, through those forces that no one can explain, the material counterparts of that desire. This now brings us to the principle that constitutes the most important part of this lesson, if not the most important part of the entire course. When two or more people ally themselves in a spirit of perfect harmony for the purpose of attaining a definite end, if that alliance is faithfully observed by all of whom it is composed, the alliance brings, to each of them, power that is superhuman and seemingly irresistible in nature. Science has yet to determine the name of the law behind this statement, but it is this law that I have had in mind throughout this course when I repeatedly refer to the power of organized effort. Editor's Commentary. The organized effort of Steven Spielberg, Jeffrey Katzenberg, and David Geffen in the formation of DreamWorks SKG is an excellent contemporary example, since 1994, of an alliance for the purpose of attaining a definite end, theirs being to produce live-action motion pictures, animated feature films, television programming, home video entertainment, records, books, toys, and consumer products. To that end, they continue to further ally with other companies and individuals in the pursuit of each of those goals. In 1998, Paul Allen, already a board member, increased his investments in DreamWorks, demonstrating his faith in the company and its partners, according to a spokesman for Allen's Vulcan Ventures. Allen is the billionaire co-founder, with Bill Gates, of Microsoft. Early in 2002, DreamWorks and Hewlett-Packard Company announced, according to the HP press release, quote, a three-year, multi-million-dollar technology strategic alliance aimed at revolutionizing animation production. HP will provide computing infrastructure for DreamWorks' next-generation digital studio at its main facility in Glendale, California, which will make it possible to create the latest computer-generated animation more quickly, cost-effectively, and with greater artistic quality than ever before, end quote. These are just two of the many alliances that have gone into the creation of this dynamic company, and are also examples of the basis for growth of an endless number of other successful businesses. Now back to Napoleon Hill's original text. In chemistry, we learn that two or more elements may be so compounded that the result is something entirely different in nature from any of the individual elements. For example, ordinary water, known by the formula H2O, is a compound consisting of two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen. But water is neither hydrogen nor oxygen. This marrying of elements creates an entirely different substance from that of either of its component parts. The same law through which this transformation of physical elements takes place may be responsible for the powers resulting from the alliance of two or more people in a perfect state of harmony and understanding for the attainment of a given end. This world, and all matter, is made up of a form of energy. On the other hand, thought, and that which we call the mind, is also a form of energy. Thought, in other words, is organized energy. Now, if all matter, in final analysis, consists of energy, and if the mind is nothing but a form of highly organized energy, it is possible that the laws which affect matter may also govern the mind. And if combining two or more elements of matter in the proper proportion and under the right conditions will produce something entirely different from those original elements, as in the case of H2O, do you not see how it is possible to so combine the energy of two or more minds that the result will be a sort of composite mind that is totally different from the individual minds of which it consists? You have undoubtedly noticed that you are influenced in the presence of other people. Some people inspire you with optimism and enthusiasm. Their very presence seems to stimulate your own mind to greater action, and this not only seems to be true, but it is true. You have also noticed that the presence of some others had a tendency to lower your vitality and depress you, a tendency which I can assure you was very real. What, then, do you imagine could be the cause of these changes that come over us when we come within range of certain people, unless it is the change resulting from the blending or combining of their minds with our own and producing something entirely different from the original elements? There is no known method for proving this to be true, but I have given it many years of serious thought, and I always come to the conclusion that it is at least a sound hypothesis. You need no proof, however, that the presence of some people inspires you, while the presence of others depresses you. So it stands to reason that the person who inspires you and arouses your mind to a state of greater activity gives you more power to achieve, while the person whose presence depresses you and lowers your vitality has just the opposite effect on you. You can understand this much without the aid of a hypothesis and without further proof than that which you have experienced time after time. Come back now to the original statement. When two or more people ally themselves in a spirit of perfect harmony for the purpose of attaining a definite end, if that alliance is faithfully observed by all of whom it is composed, the alliance brings, to each of them, power that is superhuman and seemingly irresistible in nature. Study closely the emphasized parts of the foregoing statement, for there you will find the mental formula which, if not faithfully observed, destroys the effect of the whole. One atom of hydrogen combined with one atom of oxygen will not produce water, and nor will an alliance in name only, that is not accompanied by a spirit of perfect harmony, produce power that is superhuman and seemingly irresistible in nature. Plant a tiny apple seed in the right sort of soil, at the right time of year, and gradually it will burst forth into a tiny sprig. Then in time, it will expand and grow into an apple tree. That tree does not come from the seed alone, or from the soil, or from the elements of the air, but from all of these sources working together. When two or more people ally themselves in a spirit of perfect harmony for the purpose of attaining a definite end, the end itself, or the desire for that end, may be likened to the apple seed, and the blending of the forces of energy of the two or more minds may be likened to the seed, the air, and the soil, out of which come the elements that form the material objects of that desire. I know of a family of mountain folk who for more than six generations have lived in the mountainous regions of Kentucky. Generation after generation of this family came and went without any noticeable improvement of a mental nature, each generation following in the footsteps of its ancestors. They made their living from the soil, and as far as they knew or cared, the universe consisted of a little spot of territory known as Letcher County. They married strictly in their own set and in their own community. Finally, one of the members of this family strayed away from the flock, so to speak, and married a well-educated and highly cultured woman from the neighboring state of Virginia. This woman was an ambitious person who was well aware that the universe extended beyond the borders of Letcher County and covered, at least, the whole of the southern states. She had heard of chemistry, botany, biology, pathology, psychology, and many of the other subjects that were of importance in the field of education. When her children reached an age of understanding, she talked to them of these subjects, and they in turn began to show a keen interest in them. One of her children is now the president of a great educational institution where most of these subjects are taught. Another of them is a prominent lawyer, while still another is a successful physician. Her husband, thanks to the influence of her mind, is a well-known dental surgeon and the first of his family, for six generations, to break away from the traditions by which the family had been bound. The blending of her mind with his gave him the needed stimulus to spur him on and inspired him with ambition such as he never would have known without her influence. Editor's Commentary. It's quite possible that Hill knew of this family from his childhood when he lived in Wise County, Virginia, deep in the Blue Ridge Mountains on the Kentucky border. It's also possible that he created the story by way of example, based it somewhat loosely on his own family, and combined it with the details of others he knew. As told in Michael Ritt's biography of Napoleon Hill, A Lifetime of Riches, Napoleon's father, James Monroe Hill, immigrated to America from England and adapted well to mountain living. Having learned the printing trade from his father, after he was married he made his own printing press and published the county's first newspaper. But it provided little income, so in 1883, when Knapp was born, James gave up the paper to work as a blacksmith and farmer. He later helped establish a local post office where he became postmaster and was also a trader and ran a general store. When Napoleon was nine, his mother died. A year later, his father married Martha Ramey Banner, a well-educated, cultured woman who, in addition to imparting knowledge and values to Napoleon and his brother, would later encourage James to become a dentist. But Martha's greatest contribution may have been to turn Napoleon from a wild kid who terrorized the county, toted a six-shooter, and posed a serious disciplinary problem into a young man with a direction and dreams of success. When Napoleon was 12, Martha offered to replace his gun with a typewriter, saying, "If you become as good with a typewriter as you are with that gun, you may become rich and famous and known throughout the world." Whether he accepted her offer as quickly as he accepted Carnegie's is unlikely, but her early influences would certainly have prepared him for that day. Continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. For many years, I have been studying the biographies of those whom the world calls great, and it seems to me more than a mere coincidence that in every instance where the facts were available, the person who was really responsible for the greatness was in the background, behind the scenes, and seldom heard of by the hero worship. Henry Ford is one of the modern miracles of this age, and I doubt that this country, or any other, ever produced an industrial genius of his equal. If the facts were known, they might trace the cause of Mr. Ford's phenomenal achievements to a woman of whom the public hears but little, his wife. We read of Ford's achievements and of his enormous income and imagine him to be blessed with matchless ability, and he is. Ability of which the world would never have heard had it not been for the modifying influence of his wife, who cooperated with him during all his years of struggle, in a spirit of perfect harmony, for the purpose of attaining a definite end. I have in mind another genius who was well known to the entire civilized world, Thomas Edison, who was married to one of the most remarkable women in America. Few outside of the Edison family know to what extent her influence has made Edison's achievements possible. Mrs. Edison once told me that Mr. Edison's outstanding quality, his greatest asset above all others, was that of concentration. When Mr. Edison begins an experiment, or research, or investigation, he never lets go until he either finds what he is looking for or exhausts every possible effort to do so. Night after night, Mr. Edison works with such enthusiasm that he requires but 3 or 4 hours of sleep. Behind Mr. Edison stand two great powers. One is concentration, and the other is Mrs. Edison. In Lesson 13, Volume 4, you will see the principle of allied effort carried to proportions that almost stagger the minds of all who have not trained themselves to think in terms of organized thought. This course itself is a very concrete illustration of the principle underlying organized effort, but you will observe that it requires all the lessons of this entire course to complete the description of this principle. Omit a single one of the lessons, and the omission would affect the whole as the removal of one link would affect the whole of a chain. As I have already stated in many different ways, there is a well-founded hypothesis that when one concentrates one's mind on a given subject, facts of a nature that is closely related to that subject will pour in from every conceivable source. The theory is that a deeply seated desire, when planted in the right sort of mental soil, serves as a center of attraction for everything that harmonizes with the nature of the desire. Dr. Elmer Gates of Washington, D.C., is perhaps one of the most competent psychologists in the world. He is recognized throughout the world, both in the field of psychology and in other directly and indirectly related fields of science, as being a man of the highest scientific standing. After Dr. Gates has followed a line of investigation as far as possible through the usual channels of research, and has all the recorded facts at his command, he then takes a pencil and a notepad and sits for further information. His term sitting means concentrating his mind on that subject until thoughts related to it begin to flow in upon him. He told me that many of his most important discoveries came through this method. It was more than 20 years ago that I first talked with Dr. Gates on this subject. Since that time, through the discovery of radio, we have been provided with a reasonable hypothesis through which to explain the results of these sittings. The ether, as we have discovered through the modern radio apparatus, is in a constant state of agitation. Sound waves are floating through the ether at all times, but these waves cannot be detected beyond a short distance from their source, except by the aid of properly attuned instruments. Editor's comment. In Napoleon Hill's reference here to the discovery of the modern radio apparatus, we are reminded that, when he was writing this, the average person's knowledge of radio was less than 25 years old. In the early 1890s, a number of people had been experimenting with radio signals. Professor Oliver Lodge, a British physicist at Oxford, had already succeeded in transmitting Morse code signals over a relatively short range. But for him, it was just an academic exercise, and he didn't pursue it further. In 1895, after building the equipment and transmitting electrical signals over short distances at home, Italian inventor Guglielmo Marconi became obsessed with the idea of sending messages across the ocean. In 1901, he built a powerful transmitter at the southwest tip of England, then installed a receiving station at St. John's, Newfoundland, and on December 12, 1901, he received signals from across the Atlantic. Following Marconi's success, one report said that his ideas were the products of Lodge's mind, not his own. Lodge, however, had failed to see the potential application of wireless, while Marconi understood it and set about applying it. In light of the thinking of the time, it is not hard to see why Hill might have seen this new principle of sending and receiving radio wave vibrations as being the answer to the phenomenon we've all experienced of picking up vibes from other people. Although Hill's theory was not proven to be right, it should also be pointed out that no one has yet come up with a better explanation. Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text. Now, it seems reasonable to suppose that thought, being the most highly organized form of energy known, is constantly sending waves through the ether, but these waves, like those of sound, can only be detected and correctly interpreted by a properly attuned mind. I have not a doubt that when Dr. Gates sat down in a room and placed himself in a quiet, passive state of mind, the dominating thoughts in his mind served as a force that attracted the related or similar thought waves of others. Taking the hypothesis just a step further, it has occurred to me many times that every thought that has ever been released in organized form from the mind of any human being is still in existence in the form of a wave and is constantly passing around and around in a great endless circle. It may be that by the act of concentrating your mind with intensity on a given subject, you send out thought waves that reach and blend with those of a related or similar nature, thereby establishing a line of communication between the one doing the concentrating and the thoughts of a similar nature that have been previously set into motion. Going still a step further, may it not be possible to so attune one's mind and harmonize the rate of vibration of thought with the rate of vibration of the ether that all knowledge that has been accumulated through the organized thoughts of the past is still available? With these hypotheses in mind, go back to Lesson 2, Volume 1, and study Andrew Carnegie's description of the mastermind through which he accumulated his great fortune. When Carnegie formed an alliance between more than a score of carefully selected minds, he created one of the strongest industrial forces that the world has ever witnessed. With a few notable and very disastrous exceptions, the men constituting the mastermind that Carnegie created thought and acted as one. And that mastermind, composed of many individual minds, was concentrated on a single purpose, the nature of which is familiar to everyone who knew Mr. Carnegie, particularly those who were competing with him in the steel. You will understand from this lesson that the object of forming an alliance between two or more people, and thereby creating a mastermind, is to apply the law of concentration more effectively than it could be applied through the efforts of one person. The principle referred to as the mastermind is nothing more nor less than group concentration of mind power on the attainment of a definite object or end. Greater power comes through group mind concentration because of the stepping up process produced through the reaction of one mind on another or others. If you have followed Henry Ford's record, even slightly, you undoubtedly have observed that concentrated effort has been one of the outstanding features of his career. Nearly 30 years ago, he adopted a policy of standardization as to the general type of automobile that he would build, and he consistently maintained that policy until the change in public demand forced him in 1927 to change it. Editor's Commentary. Henry Ford's consistency extended also to the color of the Model T, 15 million of which in 19 years of production from 1908 to 1927 were made only in black and with little change in the design. A few years after its introduction, Napoleon Hill met with Ford to talk about the principles of success. According to Hill, in Michael Arrit's biography of Hill, A Lifetime of Riches, Henry Ford was cold, indifferent, unenthusiastic, and spoke only when forced to. Early on, few people other than Carnegie could foresee the success Ford would achieve, which Hill attributed in large part to Ford's concentrated effort. At Hill's first meeting with him in 1911, the only thing Ford was interested in talking about was his Model T. After Ford took him for a spin around the factory, Hill bought one for $680. Continuing Napoleon Hill's original text. When I met the former chief engineer of the Ford plant a few years ago, he told me of an incident that happened during the early stages of Mr. Ford's automobile experience, which very clearly points to concentrated effort as being one of his prominent fundamentals of economic philosophy. On this occasion, the engineers of the Ford plant had gathered in the engineering office to discuss a proposed change in the design of the rear axle construction of the Ford automobile. Mr. Ford stood around and listened to the discussion until each man had his say. Then he walked over to the table, tapped the drawing of the proposed axle with his finger, and said, "Now listen. The axle we are using does the work for which it was intended, and does it well, and there's going to be no more change in that axle." He turned and walked away, and from that day until this, the rear axle construction of the Ford automobile has remained substantially the same. It is not improbable that Mr. Ford's success in building and marketing automobiles has been due, very largely, to his policy of consistently concentrating his efforts behind one plan, with but one definite purpose in mind at a time. A few years ago, I read Edward Bok's book, Man from Maine, which is the biography of his father-in-law, Mr. Cyrus H. K. Curtis, the owner of the Saturday Evening Post, the Ladies Home Journal, and several other publications. All through the book, I noticed that the outstanding feature of Mr. Curtis's philosophy was that of concentrated effort behind a definite purpose. During the early days of his ownership of the Saturday Evening Post, when he was pouring money into a losing venture by the hundreds of thousands of dollars, it required concentrated effort, which was backed by courage such as but few men possess, to enable him to carry. Read Man from Maine. It is a splendid lesson on the subject of concentration, and it supports, to the smallest detail, the fundamentals upon which this lesson is based. The Saturday Evening Post is now one of the most profitable magazines in the world, but its name would have been long since forgotten had not Mr. Curtis concentrated his attention and his fortune on the one definite purpose of making it a great magazine. Editor's Comment. Man from Maine was reprinted as recently as 1983, but at this writing it is not in current stock at either Barnes & Noble or Amazon. There are, however, used copies available through both, and no doubt used book dealers would also be able to locate copies. In the time since Hill wrote his ringing endorsement of Man from Maine, there have been numerous such biographies and autobiographies that speak to the importance of concentrated effort and to all of Hill's other principles as well. As of the 1980s, and continuing into the 21st century, the business biography bestseller has practically become its own publishing genre. So much so that there are literally too many bestsellers from which to select a best of listing for inclusion here. Any such choice we would make would not necessarily be the best, but merely reflective of the interests of the person doing the choosing. There are best-selling books and audiobooks by and about the insiders who run every industry from airlines, automobiles, cosmetics, computers, department stores, hotels, internet companies, movie studios, multinational conglomerates, real estate empires, television networks, toy companies, sports teams, and wineries, and I'm sure whatever other industries start with X, Y, and Z. As a final note, there are two books that the editors recommend that are not by or about a single individual or industry. The books are In Search of Excellence by Tom Peters and Breakthroughs by P.R. Nyack and John M. Ketteringham. Each of these books deals with the broad spectrum of industries, and within each industry, they single out certain companies and individuals for analysis. Both were published at the beginning of the business book trend in the 1980s, but there are few books since then that better convey the importance of the person focused on a good idea. In Search of Excellence, recently chosen by a panel of experts as the most influential book of the past 20 years, was a runaway bestseller and will likely be in print for years to come. Breakthroughs may be harder to find, but it will be well worth the effort.